Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. We've got a wonderful conversation coming up. When we, you know, stop and think about the Republican Party, it still has a few stalwarts who still stand by the conservative principles of the GOP, but also know that the country matters more than the party, that also know their responsibility as elected officials, as political leaders, is first and foremost to the founding principles, the Constitution, and the ideas that form the country. Adam Kinzinger is that individual. He served in the U.S. House of Representatives from 2011 to 2023. And after Donald Trump was defeated in the 2020 presidential election cycle, Kinzinger became known for his vocal opposition to Trump's claim of voter fraud and attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Kinzinger was one of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Trump or for incitement of insurrection in his second impeachment, and one of only 2 Republicans to vote to create a select committee to investigate the 2021 United States Capitol attack. He's that guy, stand-up guy, who's going to stand up and put the country first. And subsequent to his appointment, he got turned on by the party. They came after him. They came after him. They came after Liz. They came after others. But he stood his ground because the country mattered more. He's the founder of Country First, an organization that represents the reasonable majority of Americans from all across the political spectrum who demand better of their leaders and who expect more from their leaders. He is, without a doubt, someone that you want to hear from. He's got a new book. He's the author of Renegade, Defending Democracy and Liberty in Our Divided Country. And Adam joins us next here on the Michael Steele Podcast to get into Renegade, Country First, and a whole lot more. Well, hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I am excited to have my friend back with us, Adam Kinzinger. You know him from his not just his work on the January 6th committee, but the work he's been doing across the country, talking about democracy and pushing forward the agenda of trying to save us from ourselves, if you will. Adam, good to see you, man.
Hey, it's good to see you. I'm like, today I'm a little, I woke up to see some McCarthy tweet that I'm just like sitting here angry about today. But other than that, I'm in a great mood. How are you?
What a way to wake up, dude. Come on.
Yeah. That's why I've tried to like commit myself now to, okay, when you wake up in the morning, don't look at Twitter because right, that just ruins the rest of your day.
It's not worth it. What you do, baby, is you get yourself a nice cup of coffee and you put a shot in it, and then you start your day.
The old eye opener.
That's it. It's good seeing you, man. You're looking good. You're feeling good.
You too. Yeah, I'm doing great. We moved to Texas, so I escaped the winter.
Did you? Texas. Dude, that's as bad as going to Florida. What the hell?
It is. But I'm going to tell you, so like the summer's terrible. The politics here is weird, obviously. But right now, I mean, today it's a little chilly, but you know, yesterday it was 70. And so I'm like, okay, I got it. I'm in. I'm good. So I don't know if we'll stay here, but we're here for now.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I'm glad you're doing well. So look, let's get, I mean, there are a couple of things that you've got popping right now that's important to talk about. Obviously, the book Renegade, Defending Democracy and Liberty in Our Divided Country, which is a compelling read. It's a very important read. I've been trying to get a lot of folks who listen to this podcast to really pick up the books that we bring on, because they're on for a reason. and there are important messages that need to be heard and understood. And yours is one of them for sure, in terms of not just telling the January 6th story, but the overall theme around democracy. Walk us into what the book is trying to convey to folks and to help them understand and contextualize from January 6th, what you saw rising within the ranks and halls of Congress as a member before we even got to January 6th.
Yeah, so it's interesting, because now that Liz's book is out and I'm about halfway through her book, she does a really good job of picking up the story in great detail, greater detail than if it was my charge than I could have even written, because she's just so deep in the trenches on all this stuff. So she picks up from basically election day to present day. I touch on that time frame, but one of the things I wanted to do, because when I'm sitting back thinking about this and I was approached about writing something, it's like, okay, writing a book about yourself feels inherently arrogant. Because it's like, who cares about me, right? Like, who cares? I don't even care about me. So,
tell everybody else for.
Yeah. But one of the things I realized is my time in politics, even when I was a kid, but particularly when I came into office in 2010, it tells the broader story of what's happened to the GOP. Because you get this all the time, Michael, where people are like, what happened? How did we get here? The questions of, has this always been the case? Or, did Donald Trump cause this? And so with the book, what I do is I tell a little of my history, my story, but then I talk a lot about what I saw happen in the last 10 years, the fights, or last 12 years, I guess, the fights, the fact that, at one point in 2014, I think it was, we thought we had pushed back against the crazies in our party with a lot of establishment wins. That was, the year of I'm not a witch and those kinds of things.
Oh, yeah, I remember that well.
And then out of nowhere, at a time when we thought we were winning, Donald Trump comes onto the scene and the battles and talking about, the folks that were against him and then all of a sudden completely for him and watching what happened during his tenure. And so I think my book and Liz's pair really well to tell the story of January 6th in detail, but then to tell the roadmap of how we got here. I get, Democrats will always say to me, like, oh, how come you didn't see this coming? And I'm like, well, look, in a way, I can look back now and say, yeah, there were signs that this was coming. There were also signs that this wasn't going to happen. There were signs that, normalcy would win out.
Right.
And the reality is we fought a battle that we lost, and we need to tell that story.
Well, so when I hear people say that, why didn't you see this coming? And think about that. It's really frustrating in some respects, Adam, is the onus is on Republicans in the sense that we are seeing a very illiberal, anti-democratic, attitudes certainly and actions materializing within the party. But what I try to get them to understand is that if you fall into the trap of thinking this is just Republicans, you will never understand how Donald Trump won in the first place, because he didn't just win with Republicans. Of the seven or eight million additional votes he got in 2020, they weren't all Republicans. And so Republicans like you and me, trying to remind folks of the broader narrative of what this is about, becomes that much more challenging, because people want to fixate and put the finger of blame on the party. And yes, not diminishing that at all, but to the broader question of, well, okay, if all these Republicans are behaving this way, how is this man still winning? And why, when national polls are showing him up on Joe Biden by 4 points, you mean there are that many more Republicans in the world, in the U.S., than there are Democrats? I don't think so. Right. And it's just really frustrating to try to get people to sort of zoom out the lens a little bit and just kind of look at this thing in a bigger picture and realize there's a reason why you didn't go to grandma's house for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
She was getting on your last nerve talking about Donald Trump.
Exactly. And it's interesting. So you brought it, like, there's like eight ways I could go with this. I'll start with, you know, it also is frustrating to me because the tendency of the people that say, like, oh, you should have seen this coming, are the same ones that now are not welcoming to, like, we'll call them born again Republicans, like that recognize the danger of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You have to welcome them into the coalition, because I'm going to tell you, without people like you and I who were fairly early on, but even people coming along now, without those numbers, you can't win. You can't win a national election. So yeah. If your joy is to sit around and say, like, oh, I like being in the minority, I like losing, well, then fine, you're doing a great job of it. But if you want to win, you're going to have to welcome these folks. And the other thing is, and this is a whole kind of a different subject, but it's sort of along the same line. It's interesting to me, the number of, you know, when I used to make calls to houses or, you know, stop by folks when I was running for office, usually the wife, so let's take baby boomers, usually you go in, the baby boomer husband is the one that's interested in politics, and right. The wife usually didn't care. For some reason, and I don't know the answer to this, that is kind of almost flipped on its head. And you see at these Donald Trump rallies, you know, these baby boomer generation women that are going like crazy for this guy, like it's the Beatles. And I don't understand. He touched something that really sparked probably the fear in some of these folks that turned them into, like, you know, rock star fans. And I wish I could say I could figure out what the answer and what the reason is. I can't, but it's
there. Well, that's interesting you raise that. I've heard a couple of different analysis on that. And one of them, which I hear fairly consistently, is that in large measure, we're talking about white suburban women who went for Donald Trump by 52% in 2016, close to that in 2020, again, winning the white suburban woman's vote, that one social theorist put it this way to me, that these women are actually kind of reflecting their concern for their families and their men. In other words, they're reflecting the interest of their husbands and boyfriends as much as they're reflecting their own. They're reflecting their interest for their families. And it was a very interesting, I mean, I don't know how much of that is accurate, but it was very plausible to me to see, particularly in talking to some, I was like, well, after you saw the Access Hollywood tape and this guy said he loves grabbing women by their private parts, you still voted for him. Mm-hmm. and they're like, yes, but. And then what really kind of brought it home for me, Adam, was and folks who listen to podcasts know I've talked about this, was the focus group I saw probably about 2-3 months before the general election in 16, in which this white suburban woman, divorced, two kids from New Hampshire, when asked why she was supporting Donald Trump, her response was, because he's just like me. Mm-hmm. Very matter of fact, very like, well, duh, why don't you see that, right? And it really does speak to what you just said about Donald Trump having touched something with these voters in which they see him as reflecting their frustrations, their anxieties, their interests in a way that the party certainly didn't, and no other candidate can. Now, I think some of that has to do with the fact they probably watched Donald Trump on TV for the preceding 10 years or so, firing people, so he was strong, he was the boss.
Right, yeah.
You know, although folks, just hate to break it to you, it was all scripted, all right?
This
was not innate leadership here. This was, the script said, hey, you're fired, because we knew who was going to be fired that week. But it is interesting. You raise an interesting point about how you see this represented demographically at his rallies and how that's changed. And now on the other side of that, Adam, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. You're seeing a growth in the number. I was just having this conversation this past weekend of African-American men in particular who are leaning into Trump in 2024, in which you're probably going to see him pick up a bigger share of that vote than he got in the last election.
Well, it's interesting. So, okay, so there's two points on that. So when we talk about the idea of security, you know, feeling safe, looking tough, right? Now, if we were actually in a war, you know, like America was threatened, 9/11 style war, and you could put like Donald Trump up against, let's say, Mitt Romney.
Right.
There's no doubt in our minds, and probably most people's minds, honestly, that Mitt Romney would do a better job of defending this country at that moment. The problem is Mitt Romney is very soft-spoken. He's very well-mannered. He would use, in a calm way, the power of the federal government to destroy our enemies. Donald Trump, who's actually quite scared, to be honest with you, to use the power of the government. I mean, he's made the only brave military thing he ever did was killing Soleimani, which I still give him credit for and should.
Right.
But he was very scared of Xi, of, you know, Kim Jong-un. He was scared of Putin, or at least an admiration of him. But the way he talks reflects that like anger we feel. So let's say Al-Qaeda attacks us on 9/11. We want to go out and be like, let's blow them up and let's do angry things. You know, George W. Bush showed our anger, but he did it in a professional way. Donald Trump gets to the guttural instinct, and that was his advantage. And most leaders know, and I talk about in the book, most leaders know that, you know, in your heart is a fight of light and darkness, and that fight happens all day, every day. When a leader stands up and says the dark parts of your hearts, it gives you permission to let that overtake you.
Yes.
And that is a comfortable feeling, even though it destroys you in the long run, to let that fear and that darkness overtake you and to have it confirmed by somebody else. And this goes into the issue of men. So one of the things I get angry as kind of a middle-aged man is when I see things like people talking about toxic masculinity,
mm-hmm.
or people talking about you can't have two genders. You know, I mean, I know we're touching a really controversial area, but I'm just speaking, you can either ignore what I'm saying or not, but ignore it at your peril, which is men feel like our value to society is being pushed aside and disregarded.
Right.
Now, the problem is, instead of having a mature discussion about that and what are masculine values, because to me, masculine values are defending the weak, defending the defenseless, standing up for your family, standing up for truth and justice. That to me is a very masculine value. What's happened, since nobody's talking about that, you have people like Andrew Tate, like Elon mm-hmm. Musk, like Donald Trump, who say being a man is crap talking people on Twitter. It's standing up and not caring about values. It's speaking angrily. And in the absence of a real discussion about masculine traits, this angry discussion about masculine traits has won the day. And I think that's what's effective to white men. I think that's what's been effective to African-American men, to Hispanic men.
Yeah.
Is that they feel like their value to society is being disregarded, and somebody is coming along to say that. They're unfortunately saying the wrong words and using it for the wrong reason.
And that sort of gets, I think, to the heart of what you point out in your book, this idea of this slow, steady descent into dysfunction and the rise of dysfunctional forces that are pushing out extremism. Talk a little bit about that aspect of the book, because it really is sort of the girding of the narrative. Is the top side is obviously the January 6th stuff, but you know, you really want to get us to focus on this dysfunction, this idea that this rise of extremism, there is a consequence to it. There is a result from it. But at the same time, these other things are this dysfunction is also giving rise. It's feeding more of the extremism.
Yeah, it's kind of like It's like, what's the, it's, I guess, kind of a vicious cycle or a self-feeding cycle. So I use the example of this coal mine in, it's either Ohio or Pennsylvania, I think it's Ohio, that's basically been on fire for like 40 years, 50 years. So they basically they've lit a fire in a coal mine, and you know, obviously fire feeds on coal. And so they had to seal up this mine. So every now and again, when they're digging or something punctures the earth, this fire comes up again, right? And they have to quickly cover it up. But basically, this coal mine is at least eternally for the moment on fire in the ground. And so what you have in extremism, and you've had this thing burning for, I don't know, however long you want to take it, like as far back as I can go, where every now and again, something will puncture, you'll see that fire, you know, you'll see Charlottesville or you'll see something like that. But usually we close it up and we're like, no, that, you know, we can try to control that fire and whatever. And sometimes politicians use that fire in very short periods to win elections. They'll you know, make a little fearful things and talk about immigrants or the revolving door, you know, where it's obviously talking about Black people getting out of jail. Right. But then you kind of cap it. But what Donald Trump did is he came along, he broke open that fire and he let it go. And now it's spreading on the surface. So it's being fed underground, but it continues to spread on the surface because nobody is coming to stop it. So we're never going to get rid of extremism. There will always be extremism on the right. We're starting to see this on the left, by the way, on some of this pro-Hamas stuff.
Right.
And so that will always exist, but leaders have to come along with the tools to put this out. And so what I saw, you know, for instance, in 1992, as a kid, I was 14, I went to the Christian Coalition Convention in Lynchburg, Virginia, with where George H.W. Bush came and spoke. And this represented the first time that mainstream GOP and kind of evangelical conservatism got into this marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, Bush came and like was uncomfortable, but he did it. But from that point on, you basically had evangelicalism, and I say this as a political movement, not as a religion, start to overtake and spread in the GOP.
Yeah,
and I was raised in a very, I would call almost a cultish religion, Independent Fundamental Baptist. And I saw over time, as I speak that language, how they would take prophecies from the Bible or they would take fears from the Bible, implement it into present day politics and use that to win elections. That's being done, by the way, now out in the open. It's not it's not even pretend anymore. I mean, when you hear the word globalism, it's funny because people that weren't raised in this environment think globalism is some euphemism for Jews. It can be, but it's not. I know globalism as a euphemism for the one world order that the Antichrist is bringing. And anybody that's not on Donald Trump's side must actually be for the Antichrist. Actually, interestingly, if you compare Antichrist traits, probably I think Donald Trump would fall more in that.
Yeah, he kind of picks up a few of those traits along the way. The interesting narrative around Christian fundamentalism as a political force really began after the 76 election, because Reagan was not popular. People forget the establishment of the Republican Party did not like Reagan. He was a West Coast governor, former Democrat, governor of California, and everything was anchored in the Northeast. They were trying to win the South. They didn't think they could do that with the West. And that idea of the emergence of religion into politics was the door that Reagan opened in 1980 when he invited the moral majority into the party. And for the first time, we put a pro-life plank in our platform because our platform was all about business. Republicanism up to 1980 straightforward business, did not mix the social into the political, but that opened that door, which led to your moment in the 1990s, 92, 94 with George Bush. And you have this sort of steady escalation of that. They don't know what to do with it now because it's overrun the party. They can't control it. And it gets back to your point about the leadership. Talk about the leadership that you saw on January 6th. from both perspectives, because I know there were those in the moment who were trying to contain what was happening, and then those who were actually trying to facilitate it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you had the election, and I remember I was never a Donald Trump fan, and I would honestly, I could say with my hand on the Bible, I was probably the most aggressive against Donald Trump as a Republican elected official in Congress. But I still, would hold my nose and say the right things as I needed to, because I wanted to survive. But that election night when he wrote, like, this is being stolen, stop the vote, right? That's when I fully jumped off the train and became aggressive. And there were a few of us, Liz Cheney obviously supported Donald Trump, kind of obviously holding her nose. And then she with me kind of did that same thing, like, okay, this is getting out of control. But everybody at each step was kind of like, okay, well then just be quiet. Next thing is we have to let the states certify the election. Okay, so everybody's quiet. We'll let the states certify. Then Donald Trump's going to go away. And then, of course, he didn't. And this is where Mike Johnson actually became one of the most corrosive influences, because at the moment I thought that, okay, states have certified, this thing's over. He comes along with his Texas lawsuit. I'm not sure if it was right before or right after, but regardless, this breathed new life into this. He knew that that lawsuit was BS. And Liz Cheney talks about having a conversation with him where he says like, look, we just have to humor him. Like, I get it, right? This is a political thing to get on this amicus brief in this lawsuit. What that did, though, it gave hope to Donald Trump.
Yep.
It gave hope to the members of Congress that signed on to it. Not just, it didn't give them hope, but it put them in a box. So now if they sign on to this lawsuit that says Texas is trying to throw out the votes of these other states, now they're fully in election denialism mode, and they have put their name on that this election was fraudulent. Once you put your name on this election is fraudulent, you've got to stick with it.
Because you got to stick with it. You're in it. Yeah. You're in it at that point.
If you truly believe it was fraudulent, you got to keep fighting. Mitch McConnell, who finally gave a speech after the votes were certified, but then I remember talking to Cory Gardner, after that certification, and I'm like, well, why are you guys still quiet on this election? And he said, well, Mitch McConnell said, since we have this special election in January, we need to stay quiet because we don't want to depress Republican turnout in January. And so this is that special election in Georgia. You think about that. Now every senator that all the base is looking to, because yes, Donald Trump is influential, but also congressmen and senators are influential too. And so now every senator, with few exceptions, is staying quiet on this issue as their base is looking to them saying, was this election stolen or not? Because they don't want to depress turnout in Georgia, which, by the way, they lost anyway.
Anyway.
And then that election happens, they lose. Now we only have one day before January 6th. And before I go off on this diatribe too much longer, in January, very early January, at the very end of December, I'm on a conference call with all the Republicans. And I'm the first kind of person to talk after the leadership gives their report. And I say to Kevin McCarthy, I said, Kevin, there is going to be violence on January 6th. Because you guys are not telling our base the truth. You own this. You're not telling them. And by the way, if I truly believed this election was stolen, my constitutional responsibility would be to be on the Capitol on January 6th. Mm-hmm. Every one of Americans should be on the Capitol. So you're convincing these people that basically they need to be there. And his response to me was just, operator, next caller, dismissive. And then we know Kevin McCarthy had this moment after January 6th of clarity until he realized that he needed Donald Trump's fundraising power. And 3 weeks later, he was at Mar-a-Lago and history was changed at that moment. So when I talk about leadership, this is where my biggest frustration is. When you're in a cult, if one or two people call out that cult in the cult, you get ostracized, you get pushed aside, and you're used as an example. If all the leaders of the cult go against the cult leader, then all of a sudden you can make a difference. But the problem is they should take the word leaders out of this job. You know, it's not leadership. It's not a leader of America. You're something, but you're not a leader.
Yeah, you're not a leader at all. And the problem, you laid out very precisely exactly the timetable here, because you have an opportunity after January 7th, after you've given the floor speeches and you've declared Donald Trump anathema, you've declared Donald Trump insurrectionist, you've declared him persona non grata, and that all, and in fact, impeachment proceedings are starting to ferment and da 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 da. And the reality of it is, you then get on the plane, you get your bank account, and you say, oh, I don't have that much money in my account. Hey, Donald. And Donald's like, yes. Can you help a brother out and send us some money? Well, I could, but. And next thing you know, you're on a flight to Mar-a-Lago to bend the knee. That's not leadership. So where did it start to break in terms of, actually, let's go back a little bit. The setting up of the January 6th committee process, there's always been this debate. I don't think so, but for those listening, it'd be good to clarify. What Republicans agreed to, what they moved away from, and why just you and Liz wound up on this committee, on the January 6th committee, as opposed to what was initially proposed, which was a full-blown bipartisan effort.
Well, it's interesting. So right after January 6th, while impeachment is being discussed, Kevin and some others countered, not with, we don't need to impeach. They countered with, some folks wanted to just do a censure. Almost everybody would have gone on the record if they were asked, and I don't know how many were actually asked on the record, but all wanted to do a bipartisan commission to investigate January 6th. Okay. Now, let's be honest, that to them was an effort to punt, right? Because instead of making the immediate decision of impeachment or anything else, it's like, oh,
Let's do a commission.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when you want to cut spending and you do a blue ribbon spend cutting, you know, right? Because you don't want to come out for anything. But they even Kevin McCarthy was aggressively for this bipartisan commission. So he empowers John Katko to negotiate with Benny Thompson about a bipartisan commission. They literally, Democrats gave on everything. They end up with this idea of a bipartisan commission that is going to be, you know, not members of Congress, but former members, so we can take the politics out of it, 50-50, everything. Well, what happens? Well, as this goes to the floor to be voted on, Donald Trump doesn't want to do it. Of course, he doesn't want to. Kevin McCarthy, just this shows how much shame he doesn't have. He didn't even try to, like, jujitsu his way from why this was the wrong commission that he wanted to do. He just all of a sudden opposed it. Surprised everybody. So this idea is killed. Okay. So now we're sitting around and like, well, we've got to investigate something. So then this idea of a committee comes up that's even more even. And Kevin rejects that. So finally, Nancy Pelosi just makes a decision. Okay, fine. We're going to force through on a party line vote a committee because we have to get this done. And so it was interesting. I talked to so many people, I think like Peter Meyer, some of these others, that even voted to impeach, that when this committee vote came up, it's like, yeah, you guys are all going to vote for this, right? Well, we're not going to vote for it because there's some issue with the subpoena power of the minority staff versus the. So what you do, and you know how this works in politics, if you don't want to vote for something, but you can't find a moral reason to, and you know you should vote the other way, you rationalize some little detail of it. And so they rationalized some issue with staff allocations. And so it only became Liz Cheney and I that voted for the creation of this committee. And, you know, and it's interesting. Obviously, we know then Kevin McCarthy put his members on. Two of those were rightly rejected by the speaker. He took his ball and went home thinking that that would kill the committee. Liz is on the committee as a Democratic seat. I was actually the only Republican occupying a Republican seat. But a funny story is, I did not want to serve on the committee at all. Okay. And I had heard rumors, you know, at the beginning when it was formed, I'd heard rumors that Pelosi was going to put a Republican on it. And I'm like, please, dear Jesus.
Don't make me dumb. No. You're like the kid in the classroom when the teacher asks a question, you're like shrinking in the seat.
I'm like hiding. I didn't want to do it. And so then it's announced it's Liz Cheney. I'm like, thank you. Yes, thanks, Liz. Thanks for being such a hero. And then when Kevin took his ball and went home, and I start hearing like, oh, there maybe she can appoint a Republican. I'm like, oh, balls. And I knew it was going to be me. And and another quick story about that. I was asked if I would do it, not by the speaker, but by like Jamie Raskin and Eric Swalwell. And I'm like, look, I don't want to do it, but I can't say no, right? It's historic. I wake up Sunday morning expecting the speaker to call me at some point and ask me. And it's already been announced that I'm on the committee. She calls me after she makes the announcement. I'm like, son of a.
That's Nancy. That's how she rolls, baby. That's how she rolls. I've known her a long time. That move does not surprise me at all. We're having a great conversation with my buddy Adam Kinzinger, former member of Congress, the author of Renegade, Defending Democracy and Liberty in Our Divided Country. He is also the founder of Country First, which we're going to talk a little bit about, your organization that's out there trying to represent rational, reasonable Americans. So we're going to have some more fun with Adam, a little bit more January 6th, but I want to get his take also on the current crazy. We're talking old crazy. And there's new crazy since Adam was in Congress. Coming back with Adam Kinzinger right after this.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. Michael Steele here and my buddy Adam Kinzinger in the house. He's joining the neighborhood, coming through, talking about his new book, Renegade, Defending Democracy and Liberty in Our Divided Country. It's a great sort of bookend moment for both Adam and Liz. Liz's book just came out last week. Yours has been out a few months before. So you got the bookends from not just Republicans' perspective on January 6th, but from the perspective of people, yourself and Liz, who were fighting on two fronts. You were trying to move the needle on this committee to keep it from falling into the very partisan divide that it, you know, these things have a tendency to fall into, as well as fighting your own troops while you're serving on this committee. How did you get a lot of, I'm glad you're there, Adam?
Yeah.
I wish I could be there with you, bro, but you know, I'm glad you're there and, you know, keep the fight. Oh, you guys are exposing so much. It's, you know, I don't know what's come of this party. What are we going to do? Help us, Adam, get out of trouble that we put ourselves into. And then when, of course, when you start to do that, they're like, no, I'm not showing up for a subpoena.
Yeah. I mean, look, listen, like, it's so amazing. So I never would betray personal conversations. By the way, Liz saves all her texts, obviously. So be careful what you say to Liz. I say that with affection. But I had conversations with so many people that would come up to me on the floor of the House and be like, you know, it was interesting what you said or what you guys found. Or I'd have a few people that would thank me for doing it and then say, you know, I can't because my district, blah, blah, blah. Okay, two things. Number one, my district too. Okay. I had a Republican district. Secondly, like this, and this is a point that I think is important to point out. When we take an oath, it is not to our district. Like you take an oath to the Constitution. Period. Okay. So if the 700,000 people that I represented all called me on the phone and said, do not vote to impeach or do not be on this committee. Guess what? I don't care.
Right.
Because right. My commitment, my oath is not to them. It's to the Constitution. And so the people who come up to me be like, I just can't vote to impeach, or I can't support the committee because of my district. I'm like, you don't understand the oath. The oath doesn't care about your district. It doesn't. You know, now you vote for your district on certain issues, when economic reasons, whatever, but not on oath keeping reasons. And so, yeah, it just drove me nuts, the number of people. And I mean, if you put people on CIA truth serum, or if you'd have had a secret ballot vote, this stuff would have been far and away completely bipartisan.
Well, but, yeah, I think that's very true. If we had a secret ballot vote, certainly on the last impeachment, he would have been impeached. There's no doubt about that. And I actually think even on the Mueller investigation,
I do too.
There would have been enough votes to impeach, which speaks to so much of the rot inside the party. And speaking of that, one of the more disappointing moments, and you've already mentioned this gentleman who I had great admiration for, but he kind of used it all up when he came out and said that he would support Donald Trump in his Senate bid, and Peter Mayer, Major. I don't understand the thinking that you value the run for the job, the office, the possibility of winning more than anything else. And Peter doesn't seem to understand Donald Trump could give a rat's ass about him, especially since he voted against him. He voted to impeach him. You think you're going to make that up now by coming out and saying, yeah, if Donald Trump's a nominee, I'm going to vote for him and I'm going to support him? How do you even begin to square voting for the guy that you wanted to, that you did want impeached? I don't get that.
Look, this thing has been, of probably the last 6 months, excuse me, of the last 6 months, this is the most confusing thing that I have encountered. So Peter Mayer, he's actually the one I said of the 10 of us that voted to impeach, he's the one I respected the most because he was a freshman.
Yeah.
He came in, he had had, you know, 10 days on the job when he made a career-ending decision. But I'm going to tell you of whether it's impeachment or the Violence Against Women Act, every time that I voted against the party, those are the votes I'm most proud of. And the vote, obviously, I'm the most proud of is the impeachment, because I knew that was a vote of principle. When Peter decided to run, like, I thought, okay, he's going to run for Senate, probably not win, but he's going to make a stand. He's going to be out there saying what needs to be said. And he's going to set himself up, even when he loses the primary, he's going to set himself up for when and if, but hopefully when the party wakes up and he can come out with an I told you so, he's better known, and, you know, run again.
Right.
But when you come out and you all of a sudden are defending Donald Trump and saying, like, yeah, you know, I guess I don't regret impeaching, but I would support him for president because the Democrats are so bad.
It sounds stupid.
It sounds completely stupid. It's like, first off, if you voted to impeach him, you voted because you think he committed high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right.
That automatically disqualifies him. If it's just, you know, and so I don't get
it. So here's the question for Peter. Were you lying in your vote when you impeached him, or are you lying to us now?
Right,
because they don't add up. You don't say that you vote to, as you just well put, you vote to impeach because the man has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, and that's been laid out in the judicial, in the process that the Constitution requires, and you voted, you know what? You committed high crimes and misdemeanors. And now you're gonna come back and look us in the eye and go, well, yeah, He committed high crimes and misdemeanors, but I think he should be president again.
But inflation. You know, whatever.
But and Joe Biden.
Exactly. And so here's the thing. Like, I guess the logic doesn't make sense because, again, I still hold faith that at some point the GOP will wake up. Now, I don't know if that's in a year. Probably
you're,
not.
You're a good man. I held that faith, too. And I still hold degrees and strings of it. But I'll talk to you about some alternatives.
Well, I'm getting closer to you, too. but I'm hoping that there's some conservative.
I'm still a Republican.
Movement.
You're still a Republican. Yeah, so we're still in the fight, and we're here for a reason. Just folks know Adam and I have not left because it's easier to have the fight inside the tent than outside.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And plus, we piss off the Trumpers more by keeping it. So, but to wrap that up, I'll just say, like, he could have waited 2 or 4 years. Nobody's going to forget you if you voted to impeach Trump. It's not like people are going to be like, who, Peter Meyer? What was this impeachment about? He'll be somebody in 2 and 4 years. He should have made the run then. I don't understand it.
So you answered the question I was asked this weekend in an interview. And the question was, if it comes down to Biden or Trump in 2024, the easy answer is Biden. That's the easy answer for me, too. This is called no-brainer. Backing up from that line, looking at the presidential primary crap show that it has been refreshing to see Nikki Haley emerge the way she has. She reminds me of the Nikki Haley that I campaigned for in 2010 and helped get elected in her race for governor. How do you see that stacking up? What does that tell you about two things? One, the fact that the gentleman on the stage refused to coalesce behind her and give her the oomph, right? So people have dropped up, but no one's endorsed. Mm-hmm. And two, that even if you take all of that energy, Donald Trump is still at over 50% and you're 40 points behind with 30 days before the first caucus vote.
So it's interesting. I think there's actually three lanes. It's Chris Christie, it's DeSantis Haley, and it's Trump.
Right.
So everybody's trying to put pressure on Christie now to drop out. I'm personally a Christie fan because he's really telling the truth.
Yeah.
So I actually think the pressure should be, I mean, Vivek is his own dude, whatever.
Yeah. That guy Vivek is a joke. He's an ass and we know that for what he is. Right.
And, but DeSantis, I think, is the one that's not regaining momentum. He's the one that should be dropping out. Now, a percent of his will go to Trump, but I do think the majority of his support will go to Haley because there are people, you're not going to support Ron DeSantis if you're really deep down a Trumper when Trump's in the race.
Right.
And so I would like to see him drop out. He may drop out after Iowa. I think Chris Christie, unless the numbers change pretty drastically over the next 4 or 5 weeks, I think he has a right to fight through New Hampshire because
I agree.
He's put a lot of eggs in that basket. And quite honestly, like, yes, I like seeing Nikki Haley because she reminds me of the old Republican Party. But your point is solid, which is if you take everybody out, they still lose to Donald Trump. Now, the reason I think it's also good people stay in is because this is Christie's theory. And I think there's a 5% chance it's accurate, maybe 10, but it's worth exploring, which is Donald Trump goes to trial in March. You know, Mark Meadows, who was our most valuable player in the committee, even though he didn't even cooperate, is fully cooperating. There may be stuff about Donald Trump that comes out that does affect enough people to kind of wake enough folks up to say, we got to get behind somebody else. Nikki Haley, I saw this morning in some shock poll, is beating Biden by 17 points in one poll. Holy crap.
Right.
So maybe there's a chance people wake up. But look, don't put your money on it.
I put a little pin in that, a little asterisk. I warn people about national polls 10, 12 months out. They're not even a really good snapshot. They're more reactive to what's going on in the moment. The Biden campaign, Democrats can't help themselves. I still don't know how we ever lose campaigns to them, but that's another story. I really, honest to God, don't. I've never seen, I haven't lost any, so I can't say that.
Can I tell you something?
My record's good.
I came out over the last few months and have said I would vote for Joe Biden over Donald Trump. I have never, and I don't care, it's not for my ego, but I have never heard a single word or outreach from anybody in the Joe Biden campaign.
Of course not. Think, that's my point.
Yeah, I would think they'd be like all over me. And I'm not saying I would do anything for them. I necessarily wouldn't.
You're not offering. But you would think that if a former congressman who was on the January 6th committee, Republican, says, if Joe Biden and Donald Trump, Joe Biden's my vote, you would pick up the phone and go, yo, dude, can we have lunch? I mean,
Yeah, and I don't care. Again, this isn't for my ego. It just shows how inept everything is.
Because I can assure you that if the script were reversed, right?
Oh, and yeah.
We were Republicans, dude, were in the Democrats' position. We get a Democrat coming out endorsing a Republican candidate like that. Everybody, that person's getting more phone. They're like, please stop calling me.
Yes, okay. yes. I don't understand it. It's like I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I don't get it. So how do you take the drama around George Santos? That to me is a peculiar thing. It's almost as if the party was like, okay, if we must bitch slap somebody, we might as well do that now with him.
Yeah.
We don't want to do it with Trump. We didn't really want to do it with Cawthorn. We don't want to do it with Matt Gaetz. I mean, I won't even get into Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert getting felt up in a movie theater at a theater show, and people like, okay, mm-hmm. It's another good day at the office.
Family values.
But here. You had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is the easy, you know, executing a prisoner, right? You gotta shoot somebody. So this is it. And look at Matt Gaetz. Matt Gaetz's defense from the federal investigation was 17 is legal in Florida. Okay. That's been his defense. By the way, I think by this spring, just mark my words, I know things I can't say yet. I think Gaetz is toast. And I think from a legal perspective, but he should be gone, but he brings dollars with him. Yeah. He brings donors. He brings all this kind of stuff. And so look, they used Santos through the tough votes they needed, and then they threw him out. And now he's making what, $200 a cameo. Good on him. Hopefully he ends up in jail soon, but yeah, it's just, they had to execute some prisoner. You may as well shoot the guy that's annoying.
All right, speaking of annoying, McCarthy did what I said that I thought he would do, and that is, after he got his head handed to him by the very forces that he embraced, that he would leave Congress because there was nothing politically left for him. So give us your thoughts on that, knowing what you know about Kevin. I remember Kevin from the Young Gun days. He and Paul Ryan and a few others, all of that came under the umbrella of the party when I was national chairman, and we were looking at these guys, and Kevin was good with raising the money and cutting the deals with folks, although no one felt any loyalty once they wrote him a check. They were like, thank you. He didn't engender that kind of like, oh, okay, I appreciate that, dude. You know, if you need me again, let me know. But you talk about getting shoulder checked by McCarthy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that sounds like such a punk move.
It is. Look, he is. So Kevin is somebody I thought I was friends with up until the last couple of years. He was somebody I thought could be a great leader for the party because he would talk about things like, you know, the Republicans need to get on board with climate change.
Yeah.
Republicans need to get on
board. Like I said, Young Guns back in the day, it was a different conversation than the one we're having today.
Yeah, totally. And what he is as a human being is a great politician who is a shallow, moralist, vacuous shell of a human being. And so I'll tell you, like today, his tweet, he basically put out a tweet on his own Twitter that said, you know, I kept the government open to keep the military paid, even though it cost me my job, and I do it all again. And I'm just like, don't try to act to me like you now all of a sudden you stood up for some value at the cost of your job when you're the whole enabler of January 6th.
Thank you.
Whatever. But yeah, he shoulder checked me twice on the House. And he does it as he's walking by. So by the time you realize it's his security detail now in front of you because he's past you.
Right.
And it just shows that this is a guy that when you sell your soul so deeply, you begin to project anger on other people that you feel about yourself. And that's what he did with me twice. And obviously, what, a month ago, he elbows in the kidney, the dude from Tennessee. That's what happens when you feel terrible about your role, your person that you are, and you have to put it out on other people.
So it's a punk move. You do the thing in a space in which a person can't confront you and retaliate on your bullshit play. Because he knows damn well in any other setting, his ass gets
I'd have punched him. Oh, yeah. I'd have punched him right in clocked. His face. Yep. Yep, absolutely. And by the way, he's a little taller than me, but I think if it came down to who would actually win a physical exchange,
that's a no-brainer in my book, baby. I got all my money, including the mortgage on Kinzinger. There's no doubt about that. Give us your thought on the new. You've already given us some impressions from January 6th on our new speaker, Mike Johnson. His use of religion in the job, his advocacy for a Christian right government, in my view, has no place in the halls of Congress. That's not how our founders set the country up. He needs to go back and read their writings on matters of faith and religion, and particularly their own. Most of them, a lot of them were agnostic and certainly did not bring religion into it. That's why this little thing called freedom of religion found its way into the First Amendment. But give us your thoughts on the speaker.
Well, remember he said, if you want to know my governing philosophy, open the Bible. Well, there's 2 points. Yeah. Render under Caesar that which is Caesar's, and under God that which is God's. And that's also, when Jesus told Peter, and I say this as a believer, by the way, when Jesus told Peter, or told his disciples, that the state was going to come for him and execute him, and Peter says, no way, let's paraphrase here, no way, we're going to fight them. What did Jesus say? Right. So Peter is representing the thoughts of people that want to basically fight the state and take over. And that's, in fact, the disciples throughout the whole New Testament are asking Jesus when the revolution's going to start.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not hearing him when he says there's not going to be one. So when Peter says to Jesus, you know, we're going to fight, we're not going to let him take you, what does he say? He doesn't say, no, Peter, you're wrong. He says, get behind me, Satan.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
That's something pretty big to say. When the devil took Jesus up for the temptations and said, I can give you this entire world, all you have to do is bow your knee to me. And he said, again, get behind me, Satan. Jesus is making very clear that he has no concern with government.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean as a Christian in government, your beliefs don't govern your views or your philosophies. They govern mine, right? I have a moral kind of fortitude that I believe in.
Yeah.
But I represented 700,000 people, many of who didn't believe what I believed. And guess what? Have as much of a right to the throne of power in the U.S. government as I do. So there is a reason for separation of church and state. And I fully believe in it.
That to me is probably, it's something I put a really big pin in terms of watching how it plays out, because it is very concerning to me when you have public officials using religion in that manner. And I put it deliberately that way, because in my view, that is a use of religion. Look, I'm a former Augustinian seminarian. I've taken vows. I've been in a religious habit, but I'm not wearing that on my sleeve as Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, or even in my role as a political leader inside the party. To your very important point, my faith informs how I govern. My faith informs how I treat my political opponents. It doesn't dictate what I do. It doesn't dictate the terms of engagement. And I think a lot of these guys sort of setting up this false equivalency and creating this narrative around their own faith tradition, because, you know, I put it this way, Adam. It is amazing to me that the very same Christians who were once in the ring with the Lions, now sitting in the stands,
correct,
behave the way those sat in the stands when they were amongst the Lions. Yeah. In other words, we've become the very thing that persecuted us and tried to break and diminish our belief. And now we find ourselves, a lot of Christians, doing that very same thing.
That's right.
Trying to break and diminish the belief of others because they're not Christian enough. It's look, amazing.
Michael, this is exactly the Pharisees in the Bible.
Yes.
Are the ones that are constantly throwing stones at somebody that's not religious enough.
Right.
And it was Jesus that came along that was not seen by these religious types as any kind of a scholar of religiosity. He was seen, he hung out with, you know, people that you were never supposed to hang out
with. Yeah.
He was the revolutionary. He was the apostate. Well, you and I now believe that he wasn't the apostate. He was actually the prophet and the son of God himself. And so that's where, when I look, I had to go through a year or so of guilt when I started turning my back on this idea of separation of church and state, or when I started embracing it, because I was steeped in the tradition that said, if you're a Christian, boy, you have to go fight for your Christian beliefs in government. When I finally came to the realization that it was Jesus himself that said, let it be who you are. Show that. George W. Bush, I think, embodied this well. He said the 23rd Psalm on 9/11, but he never wore his faith on his sleeve. But guess what he did? He saved millions of lives in Africa because he had a compassion for humanity. That's what Christianity, or any religion, frankly, in government should be. Not hitting you over the head with a Bible and forcing the Supreme Court of Texas to say a woman can't have an abortion for medical emergency. This is sickness, and this has nothing to do with the God of the Bible.
Amen to that. And now we see that those very same Republicans are trying to undo that good work that George Bush did with PEPFAR and other programs in Africa. Because that's what Christians do, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. Before I let you get out of here, Adam, I'd like to get your advice for folks on conservatism and republicanism, which have now become this bastardized amalgam of MAGA. And how should we be looking at and approaching the 2024 cycle, given everything that we now know, everything that you've written about in your book, in terms of, you know, those experiences reflected in Renegade, the work you're doing, and this is a probably good opportunity to sort of share a little bit of the work you're doing with Country First. How should Republicans like myself and others be looking at this sort of Republican conservative MAGA narrative, but then even how others look at that in the context of what will be probably the hardest, most polarizing election we've had ever?
Yeah, I agree. Look, I think it's this way. So at some point in fairly recent history, you probably know the history of the party better than I do, conservatism and republicanism became married,
mm-hmm.
because Republicans weren't always conservative and all that kind of
right.
stuff. Now that MAGA has taken over the party, I think there is a divorce between conservatism and MAGA and republicanism. Now, Republicans will still, and MAGA will still call themselves conservative, but that doesn't make them conservative. So conservatism now is completely separate from the GOP and republicanism. There is nothing conservative about what it does. You know, sympathy to Russia, anti-US intervention in certain areas, obviously spending more money than the Democrats. We could go down the line. It's not conservative. So if you're a conservative listening to us right now or watching us right now, then think of yourself, you don't have a home in republicanism, okay?
Right.
So now you have to make a decision, not based on your conservative philosophy, but based on your governing philosophy. Do you believe in democracy or don't you? And I'm sure everybody listening believes in that. That's why I say we need an uncomfortable, unnatural alliance between the sane right, the center, and the left to defend democracy. So if you're a conservative, I think if it's Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, you have to vote for Joe Biden.
Yeah,
because
agreed.
We have to make sure he loses. That is the only thing on the ballot is Trump losing. So what we're doing with Country First, and it's country, the number one, ST.com, is we're making sure to bring together those that are putting the country over the party. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. If you're willing to put the country over the party, this is what we are. So we've We're pushing things like, you know, having conversations. We have a Country First Academy, which is teaching people how to run for office. The only commitment is you have to put the country over the party. And of course, on our political side, we're getting involved against extremist candidates, whether it's extremists on the left or the right, to put more moderate pro-governing people in that position. So we have many thousands of members. I don't even know what the latest is. It's pretty huge, but so I'd encourage people to take a look if you're looking for a home. And I'll tell you, my long-term goal on this is to create a whole new political platform through this, because we have to quit thinking as we thought of things 50 years ago. There's new problems, there's new solutions to them, and we need to find them.
I was going to let you go, but then you raised something and I got to ask. How do you look at this third party effort by No Labels? How do you look at what you see on the Democratic side with Robert Kennedy Jr., for example, who's now running as an independent against Biden? What's your take on what that potential impact could be on the cycle?
Well, look, Kennedy's nuts, but I've had a
but he's embraced by MAGA, so that's all that matters.
He's embraced. I had some lady tell me, like, oh, you know, basically going after Trump and then saying, I'm really interested in this Robert Kennedy. I'm like, oh, for God's sake, you know. And I think some of it is they still think he's a Kennedy, right?
Right. He is not his daddy, trust me.
Oh man. But the third party thing is gonna be a huge factor. And I worry about No Labels for the simple reason. Look, I would love to have a centrist party to vote for. Okay. I would love it. Okay. But let's just look at the math on the electoral votes. And by the way, Democrats, take this seriously, because there's too many Democrats that think like, oh, it's going to be fine, we don't need to worry. You do. Because if the third party wins any states, you've now denied 270 electoral votes and it goes to the House to vote. As we all know, it's not voted based on who has the majority in the House. It's voted based on who has the majority of delegations in the House. So Wyoming all of a sudden now has the same voting power as California.
That's right.
And it will go there if you don't reach 270 electoral votes. That's my concern with a third party effort. I actually would love to see a third party, but I think it has to start in an off year, in a not presidential year, in elections in the House of Representatives.
I've been saying that for years. In fact, you know, I take it even down a further. I've always argued for the last 20 years, just having learned from the Ross Perot race in 92, that we always start these third party efforts up at the presidential level. Right. That's a dead ender. It's not going to work. It just creates chaos in the wrong direction. But to your point, it is a down ballot opportunity, and even more so winning city council races, mayor races, state legislative races, because in the end, you have to retrain people in their voting. You have to break them of the habit of voting for the party they currently belong to, who may be more open to that approach based on what you said, in terms of, I want to, you know, I'm a center right individual. I'm looking for people who are putting the country first, who are looking to create compromise and negotiate consensus around issues, as opposed to just hardlining it. That's something you'll see taking hold much more at the grassroots level when you begin to change that, because it then bubbles up in the system. And next thing you're electing congressmen, you're electing U.S. senators, and then you're ready to do the dance with the presidency. But it is a fascinating moment for the country, as more and more people are looking at these alternatives, ranked choice voting, and other tools that they can use to sort of give the power back to voters to have a greater flexibility in who represents them in these chambers. And that's a good thing.
Right. I just think it's this vote. We have to retrain people to vote not based on issues, but governing philosophies.
Yeah.
Because what happens in these third party runs is you're like, oh, I love the idea of a third party. Oh, Joe Manchin's pro-choice. Well, I'm pro-life, so I'm going to vote for Trump.
Right.
Joe Manchin's pro-life, so I'm pro-choice. Right. We've got to get out of that two sides to every issue bull crap. And and you vote for people on issues. You vote for governing philosophies and you hold your nose on some issues.
Well, that's something you did, sir, in your time in Congress, and a lot of us appreciate that. You sort of lived up to one of the rules that I had when I entered politics, And that is do the job in front of you, do it well, and do it as if it's the last time you'll ever get to do it.
Amen.
Because then you're not worried about re-elections. You're not worried about party influences. You're not worried about trying to save face with people who at the end of the day don't give a damn about your survival or your experience or the community you represent. And you showed that in your leadership over and over and over again. You took the slings personally, your family got to see the ugly side of all of this. And yet you stand strong with Country First. And you are telling and warning us about that in Renegade. So I appreciate you, my friend, very much.
You, my friend. It's been great to be your friend, and thanks for continuing to speak out.
No, absolutely. Adam Kinziger, he's one of the best folks. Pick up the book, Renegade, Defending Democracy and Liberty in Our Divided Country. Check out the work that he's doing at Country First. Again, organization that is designed to sort of create a space for reasonable majority of Americans who are looking for fuller political expression. And as you said, if you're looking to run as a candidate, hey, check out, you know, if you, you know, you're about the country and the democracy, hey, we could use you in a few primaries, baby. So
that's right. That's
give right. Adam a call. Follow Adam on that thing called Twitter or X or whatever the hell Elon Musk is calling it these days.
And I got a Substack. So go to Substack too.
Go to Substack. Yeah. Where did they go on Substack then?
It's just, I think you just type in Adam Kinziger and you'll find me there.
Excellent. Yep. So we'll do that. Check out the book again. And Adam, all the best to you and the family. Have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas holiday and a blessed new year, my friend.
You too, my friend. Take care.
All righty. That does it for this time together, folks. Until next time, be blessed, be well, do the voodoo thing. You know I love you, do the download. I love it when you do that. Share the word. We get some great folks on like Adam to talk about events that are impacting you and giving you a different way of looking at them and thinking at them about them. But until we meet again, be safe, be well out there. Don't let the crazies get you down. There are folks like Adam and myself. We're out there on the front line. Come join us. You know, the water's nice, a little choppy, but it's still nice. And until next time, take care.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin. It's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.